Shoot, what is it?
Okay, so the earlier question had to do with, I think it's 27 in the book. So this is where we have the universe expanding. So what they tell us is that it's an adiabatic expansion. So we can use this guy here. And we can use this in the V1, T1 sort of form. So we have T1, V1 to the gamma minus 1 is T2, V2 to the gamma minus 1. Now, they don't give us volume. They give us radius. But we know that the volumes are proportional to the radius cubed. So if we want the initial temperature, we got that. And since these volumes are proportional to radiuses cubed, why is it cubed? Is that what the question?
Is that just what the volume equation is?
Yeah, but it kind of has to be just from units, because volume has to be in cubic meters, so it has to be cubed. If we really care about the constant, it's 4/3 pi. But the constant is going to cancel out. So usually we think about hydrogen as being a diatomic gas, but this is atomic hydrogen. This is just individual hydrogen atoms. So it's a monatomic gas. So we've got then gamma is 5/3. So this is 5/3 minus 1, which is 2/3. What we've got is T2 to the ratio of radii cubed and all of that to the 2/3. So the 3's go away. So we know the current temperature, that's the 3.7. And they have the ratio of the radiuses. So we should be all set. Yes, so volume pressure, which is kind of the most famous form, it's PV to the gamma. And temperature volume, it's going to be like that. And I think that's actually in the problem, or maybe it's the next problem, I can't remember. No, it's in that particular problem. And you can also, of course, if you wanted to, make the relationship between pressure and temperature if you wanted to, right? You just use the ideal gas law. Now, I'm told if you plug into this equation, you won't get the right answer. You won't get the green check. And what I'm told is that if you plug in that, you will get the green check.
Just the middle, just the R1 over R2 of R1.
It's because it says to use gamma's 1.67.
Yes, apparently. So it's basically a rounding issue. They're saying that 2/3 is 1.67. And it is almost that. And usually that sort of small difference doesn't matter, but that ratio of radii is phenomenally large. So I guess it makes enough difference. I'm told that it makes enough difference.
Could you go over the problem right before that one?
Is it 26? Okay, so what we have there is a bunch of possible lines that are connecting states.
I figured out like the first set, but I couldn't figure out like the second set.
So 26, if that's the question, has so we've got states A and B, and we've got I and F. And we have one path that goes like this. And we've got another path that goes like that. We've got one path that goes like that. And they give us the internal energies at the beginning and the end. And I guess we've got the volumes and if we want them. And for each one of these paths, we're supposed to figure out the work done and the net energy transferred by the, basically Q and W are what we're supposed to find. And of course, if you've got one, you've got the other. Right? Because the change in internal energy, which we know, is W plus Q. And this W is going to be minus the area. So for example, for this path here, the area is just that area. And that has a pressure that is 1.5 atmospheres. And it has a change in volume that is 0.5 liters. So the work is going to be minus the height. And we want to convert our atmospheres into pascals. So that's 1.01 times 10 to the fifth pascals per atmosphere. And we want to convert our change in volume into cubic meters, 0.0005. Is that 5 or 0.5? So it is 0.5 liters, so all of those O's, cubic meters. Okay, are we good to go?
Yeah.
We can get the change in internal energy is given to us just by the final minus the initial.
Okay.
More questions? Well, so we got an exam in 9 days. Sounds far off. And I'm sure you'll be using the next week to study hard for it, so there's no real reason to worry. But we usually do have a chance where you can ask questions together as a group, and it's typically the night before, or the night before the night before, or maybe before dinner. And you can see those are the votes from the earlier class, which are basically about even. Yeah, before and after dinner. So like 4 or like 7, something like that. We can negotiate those precise times. So are people... I think that's true. So some people may have lab on the Wednesday beforehand at... Well, so we're gonna vote in order. So who's for Tuesday before? Like at 4 or something like that. 1, 2. Tuesday before.
Tuesday's the day of one, right?
I won't look carefully.
Change our vote if we see.
Oh, I'll vote for before then.
Okay, so I see Tuesday before. I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Who's for Tuesday after? I see 1. Not going to be that. So who's for Wednesday before? I see 3. Ooh. And who's for Wednesday after? I see nobody, huh? So it looks like Tuesday before.
Sitting at 4 o'clock?
Well, so what time, what time works the best? I mean, 4 is kind of what I consider standard, but it could be 5.
4:30 maybe, so we can catch a bus if we have a 2:40.
So 4:30 is... 4:30 is... We're going to do it at St. Ben's then.
All right.
There are probably more women in the class than men, so it would only be fair. I should think about that for the final. Since the professor's a guy, he probably shows a bias towards the women, frankly. So Tuesday before, we're thinking 4:30. I mean, it might change a little bit here. So how to study, right? So if you go online, there's kind of a sample. It's not literally an old test since I haven't taught this class, but it's something that I've made up that's kind of like an old test. So if you go to the class website and click on lectures, and then it's 105T3X, and there's a screencast and there's a PDF of the actual test document. You might remember that we handed out the seventh quiz, but then I didn't grade it. I said I would give you the answer, so that's a screencast of it, a screencast of the one that you just had. Some people have wanted kind of a collection of the problems that we do in class. So that's in a big PDF since the last exam.
Does that include iQuiz stuff? Or just
no, it's just these. I could probably do the iQuizzes too, but I didn't. Questions? Good to go? So, you know, in a typical class, there are, you know, a few equations. So just for fun, we've got, what, 6 times 4? We've got 24 equations to learn for next time. I'm pretty sure that the right solution to this is to Xerox that and put it in your cheat sheet for the exam. I mean, I probably won't use all of those equations, but there they are sitting there, and they're all pretty easy to use. There are also potentially, you know, subtle differences, right? So this CP, that's the molar specific heat at constant pressure, and this CV is the molar heat at constant volume. So you've got to get the players right in this equation.
A lot of P's in this test.
Yeah, but and there will be rows from the earlier fluid stuff too, right? I don't think there'll be any momentas, so we won't have that P. So
P means molar, right? When it's the C sub P.
Well, so the idea is the capital C, since it looks so different from a lowercase c, is going to be used to denote molar specific heats, and the lowercase c is going to be the per kilogram specific heat. And usually it will be clear because the units will be given. But, you know, kind of for memory's sake, when we're doing the Q equals MC delta T calorimetry sorts of problems, those were all done per gram, and now that we're doing gases, they're mostly done per mole. So how these things look like on the PV diagram, I hope is pretty clear. We have the isobars, which have constant pressure. They would be a horizontal line. We have the constant volume processes, isochoric. Those would be a vertical line. The isothermals would be a hyperbole like that. And the adiabats, the constant entropy lines, are steeper than the isotherms. So in terms of those equations and other places, the symbol W in this book stands for the work that we do on the gas. And that's kind of an uncommon choice. If you were to pick up probably 80% of the books, they would not have that minus sign, and they would let W indicate the work that the gas does on us. And that's the historical usual thing to use, because people care about how much coal they have to buy for their steam engine and how much work it's going to do for them. So for us, we want big negative works so that the machine is actually producing energy, whereas for most people, they want positive numbers, so they define work the opposite as how we've done it. They're exactly opposite.
Okay.
Because Newton's third law says the forces are opposite. So if we compress the gas, we're doing work on the fluid, but force times displacement is negative for the work that it's doing on us.
Okay.
So they're exactly opposite.
So just same number, but
same number, but opposite sign.
Okay.
And as I say, most commonly, people are thinking steam engines, so they define W to be good, positive in the good case. Namely, where the machine is actually doing useful work.
So
For us, it's negative. Yeah, I think care is basically required to think for yourself whether we have expansion. If the gas is expanding out, then it's doing work on us. Whereas if we're compressing it, then we're doing work on it. And the signs are all, as far as I know, right in that table and in the book. So you could just blindly follow that result. Questions? So I think for this section, we've got more than the usual amount of verbiage before we can take a look at problems. So probably the most important concept in the next bit is entropy. And there's only one equation in the book for entropy, and it tells us that the change in entropy is the heat that we add divided by the temperature in degrees Kelvin. Historically, entropy came up as kind of an oddity. That is to say that entropy and energy conservation, those were all developed in the 1800s. And when people were working with these equations mathematically, they saw that for good engines, some quantity other than energy was conserved, was constant along a path. And Clausius gave it the name entropy because he wanted people to think about it as kind of like energy, but it's really quite different from energy. It doesn't have the same units as energy, and in particular, it can be not conserved. In fact, typically, entropy increases in process as opposed to staying constant. So the most important property of entropy is that it's a state function. And those terms are almost hard to define because it's obvious for so many of the things that we've talked about. So if we pick a spot on the PV diagram, then the temperature of that spot is determinant, right? It doesn't depend on how we got there. The ideal gas law says that if you know pressure and volume, you know the temperature. If we pick a spot on the PV diagram, we know what the internal energy is. And so entropy is something like that. It's something that could be tabulated. It doesn't depend on how you got to a particular location. It just depends on that location. So the work depends on how you go there, right? That's what that problem we were talking about does. Different paths produce different works. But for state functions, doesn't matter how you go, the value is going to be the same at that particular location. So when people first discovered entropy, they discovered it kind of as a mathematical oddity, something that was constant, that was surprising. And so the game was on to try and figure out what physically entropy was. And we know what pressure is, right? Pressure is bouncing molecules. We know what temperature is. So usually we have some sort of physical idea that corresponds to these sort of state functions. And it was perfectly unclear what that quantity was. So Boltzmann is the guy who figured that out. And he had that equation put on his tombstone that S is K times W, where W is basically the number of possible states that correspond to that macro state. So it has to do with disorder.
What's the LU?
LN, natural logarithm.
The natural log,
What do you mean by possible states?
Yeah, so I'm not sure I exactly want to talk about that. But I'll try.
Oh, please, you don't have to.
I had a friend, Mike Chen, who was, I don't know, 6'5" and maybe 300 pounds, and he's a Chinese chemist. He's a pretty unique guy. One of my roommates was a ranked amateur tennis player who was missing an arm. Pretty unique guys, pretty rare guys. Then there's me, right? Mr. Average. Right there. So there are lots of people who are mostly interchangeable with me, whereas those other people are pretty unique. They're pretty unusual creatures. So in the same sort of way, we can count the number of possible states that are basically the same in terms of their pressure, volume, and temperature. And if it's a unique state, then it has a low entropy. If there are lots of basically equivalent situations, then it's a high entropy. So at absolute zero, There's only one possibility. The atoms have to have the lowest possible energy, and there's only one state that has that. So the entropy at absolute zero has to be zero. But as we give more and more possibilities for how the energy can be distributed, there's more and more available states, and there's correspondingly more W and more entropy. So W sounds like maybe a little bit queasy thing, right? I mean, who is the same as me? I mean, I'm unique in my own way. But suffice it to say that it can be mathematically defined, and under nice circumstances, you can calculate the number of available states, and you can calculate what the entropy is.
So what does W stand for?
It's the number of possible ways you can be and still be like that.
So that's a measure of disorder.
And it's a measurement of disorder. So the idea is if you think about, and this is the analogy from the book, if you think about kind of a random set of cards dealt in poker, you know, every set of cards is unique, but on the other hand, a lot of them look pretty much the same, right? They're not worth anything. Whereas if you had a straight flush or something like that, the cards are arranged in a very unique and nice fashion. Well, it broke, of course, Boltzmann too. You remember, he's the guy who committed suicide, so. Okay, so entropy is one important concept. This is the only equation that's in the book for entropy, but I'd like to write down, it won't appear in exams, but just because it's maybe helpful, for this equation to work, all of that heat had to be added at the same temperature. You can imagine situations like if you slowly heat up a bar of aluminum, you're going to be adding heat and the temperature is going to be changing. Under those circumstances, you can show that the change in entropy is mc and then the natural logarithm of the final temperature divided by the initial temperature. So we're not going to use that equation, but if the temperature isn't constant, then we can't use the equation that's circled. We can't use the equation that's in the book for entropy changes.
So you just showed us that equation for the heck of it, but we don't need it.
You don't need to write that down on your cheat sheet. Okay, so entropy is one of the important concepts. The other kind of important, another important concept is this kind of generalized idea about heat engines. So what we have here is the same thing as we had before. We have a heat engine that is in some sense working on cold. So we have a cold temperature reservoir, which is the liquid nitrogen, and we've got a warm temperature reservoir, which is the room. And this heat engine is seemingly working forever between those two temperature regimes. So here I've got something that's hot, and here I've got something that's cold. And what must be happening is I am somehow or other taking energy away from this situation. And it has to come from someplace. The energy has to have its origin in the hot temperature regime. And you might hope that you could convert all of that heat into mechanical energy. Well, that turns out to be a statement by the second law of thermodynamics that's impossible. So one of the statements of second law of thermodynamics is that you can't convert heat into mechanical energy with 100% efficiency. That you have to take some fraction of it and dump it into the cold temperature regime. So here we have some heat that we're taking from the high temperature regime. We're dumping some heat in the cold temperature regime, and we're getting out some work in the process. Okay, so it's kind of a generalized picture. Now, it may be worth reminding you that we are treating the heats from the hot and cold temperature regimes as being separate, but the work that we're talking about is the net work. So you know that if we have a typical process on the PV diagram, we're going to get the machine is going to do lots of work on us in that expansion, and we're going to have to do some work to get it back to the original state. This W that is being described is the network that we get out of that machine. I hope the general idea of a heat engine is clear. The plan is to expand the gas when it's hot, and hence at high pressure, so we get a lot of work out of it, and then compress it when it's cold and has a low pressure. And so it doesn't take as much work to get it back to the original situation. So as long as we have a cycle like that, we can have a machine that's going to do net work on the universe. So one statement of the second law of thermodynamics is that you can't convert heat into work with 100% efficiency. Another statement of the second law of thermodynamics is the change in entropy of everything, of the universe, is always greater than or equal to zero. And if you think about that, if a process is reversible, then that means if it can run either way, then it must be that the change in entropy is zero, right? Because if you tried to, if there was some positive entropy that was produced and you tried to run it backwards, then you'd have to get negative entropy, and that's not possible. Change in the entropy in the universe is always positive. So if you clean up your room, you may think that you've decreased the disorder, but you've increased the disorder other places just by living. The net disorder of the universe is always increasing. So let's take a look at this possible situation in the context of a reversible, any reversible engine. So what we have is some entropy loss from that device, right? That Q, H is going to be negative. And let me write it explicitly as negative. So that's the heat that we're taking from the hot temperature regime. And so the corresponding change in entropy is the heat that we're taking out divided by the temperature. And we're going to dump some heat in this cold temperature regime. And I don't need the absolute values because that would usually be a positive value. And the claim is that if this engine is reversible, the change in entropy has to be zero. Now, if I put the negative stuff on the other side of the equation, I have the magnitude of heat that I remove from the high temperature regime has to equal the heat that I dump in the cold temperature regime divided by C. And by energy conservation, of course, the work that's done, so not the work I do on the gas, but the work that is done by the machine, that is just the result of a difference between the energy that I take from the high temperature regime and the temperature I take from the cold regime. Now, if you're running an engine, what you care about is how much coal you have to buy and how much work you get out. So it's useful to define an efficiency as the work I get out divided by basically how much coal I have to buy, how much heat I'm going to take from the high temperature regime. And if I plug and chug on this a little bit, we see that the work is the difference between the heat that I take from the high temperature regime and the work that I dump and the heat that I dump in the low temperature regime. So this is 1 over 1. And if I rearrange this equation a little bit, bring this down and bring this up, notice that the heat I dump divided by the heat that I take from the high temperature regime has to be the temperature of the cold regime divided by the temperature of the hot regime. So we've got then a simple equation for the efficiency of any reversible heat engine. No. So this efficiency of a reversible engine, that's the maximum possible efficiency. You can show that.
Okay. And then would that be times 100?
If we want it as a percent. Okay, so this was any reversible heat engine. What's kind of a practical set of processes that would produce this efficiency? And that was figured out by a guy called Carnot, a French engineer, famous dead French engineer. really before the start of thermodynamics in the early 1800s. And he said, consider the following process. I have a high temperature gas and I'm going to let it expand. And of course, when it expands, it's going to do work. And it's going to do lots of work because it's hot and hence has a lot of pressure. I need to get it cold if I'm going to compress it. So the plan is to have an adiabat. Remember that adiabats, when you expand something, it's going to reduce in temperature. So now that I've got the gas cold as an isothermal process, I'm going to compress it. And it's not going to take as much work because it's cold, so the pressure is less. I need to get it back to the original temperature, so I'm going to use an adiabat to get back up to that high temperature. All right, so I've got isotherms alternating with adiabats to produce a Carnot cycle. And it's reversible, so it turns out to have this efficiency. Real machines are guaranteed to have a smaller efficiency than the Carnot cycle is going to have. Now, this is a reversible process, and we do actually want to run it reverse. That is to say, you want to make a refrigerator which sucks heat out of the inside of the freezer. You do have to turn on the engine, and it's going to dump the heat into the kitchen. And it works just fine, right? You can run this process in reverse. Its whole claim to fame was that it was reversible. Now, if we're talking about things like refrigerators, then usually what we use to evaluate them is called the coefficient of performance. And what we're paying for, the bill from NSP, is the work. And what we want is to pull as much heat from the cold temperature reserve as possible. So that's what we would use for our definition of coefficient of performance of a refrigerator. And we can work out the details if we want. We know that the work is the difference between the heat that we dump in the high temperature regime minus the work or the energy that we pulled from the refrigerator. And if we divide this all through by 1 over QC, and remember that those ratios of heats for a reversible case are just the ratio of the temperatures. So we've got that relationship for the coefficient of performance of a refrigerator.
Oh, so this isn't the reverse of up there, or is?
So it is the reverse engine, but what we care about is different. So for a heat engine, what we care about is the work we get out and the amount of coal we have to buy. So the work is the good thing that we get out. For a refrigerator, the work is the thing we have to pay for, right? NSP is connected to the refrigerator. So we would like to get as much, we would like to have as little work as possible and as much QC as possible. So the coefficient of performance is the figure of merit. All of these things just depend on the temperature difference, so you kind of get what you pay for. So you get, if you're just trying to change the temperature inside your refrigerator a little bit, right? So if you're trying to keep your refrigerator at 40 degrees Fahrenheit and it's 41 degrees Fahrenheit in the garage where the refrigerator is, it doesn't take a lot of work to do that. But if it's 101, then it's going to take more work to pump that heat out. So coefficient of performance tells us for a refrigerator, tells us the ratio of what we want, namely heat removed from the freezer, divided by what we have to pay for, namely the work that we're getting from NSP. Questions? Well, so we're talking about heat engines, and actually have an old student who runs a big heat engine. So he runs a power plant in Lansing, Iowa, and you know, this is a diagram he gave me of his plant. So it's pretty complicated. let's just kind of point out some of the simple things. So these are the turbines, and notice the characteristic shape of the turbines, right? What goes in is at the small end and it comes out at the big end. That's because there's been a huge volume expansion in the adiabatic expansion that's going on in these turbines. So this is where the work is being done in order to drive these turbines around. Now, if we were to actually look at what the cycle is that these things are going through, and here's kind of a simplified version of it, what we have here is a really funny diagram, and you probably never see another one of these in your life. Typically, what we've plotted is pressure versus volume, but here it's kind of temperature is more the main thing. So I've plotted temperature, but then I've done something really stupid. I've plotted it in degrees Celsius, right? Remember that Kelvin is what really counts. And I chose that just because it made a pleasing arrangement of the numbers. So how this system works, it's not a Carnot cycle, is we start with very high pressure water. So I'm not sure you can read these scales, but this is like 2,400 pounds per square inch. So if we start out here at 1A, we have a pressure that is about 10 megapascals. It's water, so it has a pretty small volume. And notice that because of the high pressure, it can be liquid even though it's above 100 C. So here we have liquid water, and what we're going to do is this turns out to be the 311 turns out to be the boiling point of water at this pressure. So at that temperature, 311, we can convert 100% water to 100% vapor just by adding heat. How much heat do we have to add? Well, we could figure it out, right? Because we have what the entropy is at this state and that state. And we know that the change in entropy times the temperature in Kelvin is going to give us the heat that we had to add. So here we have water vapor at 311. We're going to continue to heat it until it reaches temperatures that are well above 1,000 degrees, 1,200 degrees in this case. Then we're going to put it to the turbines and we're going to get an adiabatic expansion, which is where the only power output is. If we were to look at a PV diagram here, the pressure is actually being held constant. It's all at 10 megapascals. And the volume is increasing, so there is a certain amount of work that was being done, but it's not being done usefully. The only work that is running the turbines is done in this adiabatic expansion. So the temperature decreases tremendously in this adiabatic expansion, and so does the volume, right? That's why we had these characteristic spots. So we end up here with water vapor that is at very low pressure and moderately low temperature. It just takes a little bit decrease in temperature so we can start condensing it into water. So here's the condensation phase where we have low pressure water that is could be in vapor form, could be in liquid form, and we're going to condense that water into liquid, and then we're going to pump it back into the boiler.
When you say something is an adiabatic curve, does that mean it's just decreasing in temperature or increasing in volume? What does it mean when you say adiabatic curve?
So the term adiabatic means exactly no heat gained or lost. So constant entropy, that's the same thing as adiabatic, and it means that Q is going to be zero for that process. I don't know about compensating. So typically how adiabatic processes occur practically is they happen fast. So the steam is moving through that turbine so fast that it doesn't get a chance to lose heat before it ends up being expanded and cold. Kind of another way of saying the same thing is, of course, you keep that turbine as hot as it's going to be, right? You surround it with insulator so that there's not going to be any heat lost or gained. All the heat is going to stay in. The only cooling that's going to happen is because of the expansion. So adiabatic means Q is zero, and that entropy is a constant.
Mm-hmm. So it's after the expansion that it cools, and then is that when it condenses again?
So in this cycle, we didn't quite reach the temperature that was necessary to condense, right? We needed to be a little bit lower temperature before we could start to get condensation. And notice that these are at pretty low temperatures. And what the plan is you're going to run that, the output from this low pressure turbine is going to be run, you're going to have water, river water basically, that's going to flow through it and is going to decrease the temperature till it finally condenses into water. Okay, so this is steam, this is water vapor. Now we're going to condense it into water and we're going to pump it back in as liquid water into the boiler.
I'm just wondering practically, why wouldn't you try to conserve that little bit of extra? Would it just not even be worth it? Try to conserve, like if you were going to try to conserve that little bit of extra heat, preheat the water in the input?
So first of all, it's not a little bit of heat. It actually is a fair amount of heat that you're getting rid of. Yep. But there's, if we think about it practically, it turns out there's no way of avoiding dumping this heat. In order for a heat engine to go, it has to dump heat. It's impossible to have 100% efficiency.
Well, so, I'm not saying necessarily 100% efficiency, but it just it's I just care. Maybe it's
a So maybe another way of saying it is if we're here and we want to get to there, there are lots of processes that we could do to go from here to there. All of them would involve condensing the water.
Right.
So you might imagine going, say, from here to there. That wouldn't involve condensing the water. So we would have steam all the time. And that turns out to be less efficient. There's a lot more I could say. This is not literally what happens for practical reasons, but it's a somewhat simple approximation for what happens.
All right.
In any case, it does, you do recondense it. So one other kind of detail to take from this very complicated diagram is how this final step actually happens. The way I've got it on this diagram is I'm taking cold water and I'm throwing it into a boiler that's at 300 degrees. So that means there's a huge temperature difference between what's doing the heating and what's being heated. And that leads to big differences in entropy. It means the process is irreversible. So what you want to do to have as little entropy production as possible is you want to heat something with something that's at more or less the same temperature. So you notice that this water that we got from condensing the steam, we're going to heat it up in a series of steps. We're going to bleed off steam that's at various temperatures, and we're going to use steam that's just a little bit hotter than the incoming water in order to heat that. We're going to try and keep the temperature difference between what's doing the heating and what's being heated as small as possible to limit the amount of entropy production. And if you limit the amount of energy production as much as you can, namely zero, then you're going to get Carnot cycle efficiency. Questions? Many. Some of them might be cleared up by looking at some of these homework problems. Okay, so here we have a heat engine that operates between cold temperature regime at 25 and a hot energy regime at 375. What's the maximum efficiency? So the maximum efficiency is the Carnot cycle efficiency. So all we have to do is to plug and chug. Right, so all we need to do is to take 1 minus the 25 and divide it by the 375. Wrong, right? Right? Got to have absolute temperatures.
Oh.
So I got to add my 273s in order to convert those temperatures in Celsius to absolute temperatures. Okay, so I got 273 plus 25 in the numerator. And I've got 375 and 273 added together in the denominator. Divide those guys, subtract one from it, and I get an efficiency that is 0.54, or 54% if you prefer. Each cycle of operation of a heat engine expels 2,400 joules of energy and performs 1,800 joules of mechanical work. How much thermal energy must be added each cycle? So what you want to think about is this kind of generalized picture. We have hot and cold, and we've been told that we're going to dump into the cold temperature regime 2,400 joules, and we're going to get out 1,800 joules of mechanical energy, and that energy had to come from someplace. It came from this high temperature regime. So the amount of heat that we took from the high temperature regime, all we have to do is add those numbers, and we get 4,200 joules. What's the thermal efficiency? So the general definition of efficiency, we've proved what it is for a Carnot cycle, but in general, it's the work we get out divided by the heat that we had to put in. So the efficiency is going to be the 1,800 we got out divided by the 4,200 that we had to buy in terms of coal. And that turns out to be about 0.43 or 43%. So the energy that went in was this 4,200.
4,200. That's all the energy that's inputted into the system. So how much work was that?
1,800. Yep. And we had to dump in order to make the system work 2,400.
Oh, so the hot contributed 1,800. The cold contributed 2,400.
No. All this is down. So the hot contributed 4,200, of which 1,800 was converted into mechanical energy, and the remainder, the 2,400, was dumped into the river.
Oh, the river is the cold thing.
The river is the cold thing. Okay?
So it's all coming from the hot thing.
For sure.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. You have to buy coal to make the system work. Okay. So here we have heat engine, Carnot cycle. They give us the temperatures. They say that the heat we're going to get from the high temperature regime is 21,000 joules, and the cycle time is 1 second. We're supposed to calculate the mechanical power output and how much energy are we going to dump in the river. So there are kind of, I guess, two pieces of this. The first one goes back to an earlier chapter, right? And that is that power is energy per time. And they've nicely made the time be 1 second, so it's not obvious when we're dividing by the time, because it doesn't look like anything, but we are dividing by a time when we convert watts and joules per second. Okay, so we might as well start by calculating the efficiency. And so the efficiency is 1 minus the ratio of the temperatures. The cold temperature is 80 C, so that's 273 plus 80. And the hot temperature is 273 plus 350. So the efficiency So I get efficiency of 0.43. So how much work are we getting out? Well, if we rearrange this equation, you can see that the work is equal to the efficiency times the heat that we're pulling from the high temperature regime. So we've got our 0.43, and we've got 21 times 10 to the third joules. So I've still got my 43 sitting in my calculator, so 21 exponent 3. And what I get is 9.1 times 10 to the third joules. Right, so what we've got is 21,000 joules that we're pulling from the high temperature regime. We're getting out this 9,100. The amount we're dumping in the river, we can just subtract, right? So if we just subtract these two numbers, that'll be the amount of heat that's that we're dumping in the... And I get 1.19 times 10 to the fourth joules. So we know how much started. We know how much was diverted into work. So the difference, that is to say, I subtract that from that, that gives me the amount that I'm dumping in the low temperature regime. Now, to convert these energies into power, all I have to do is divide by the time. The time is just 1 second. So it looks like I'm just crossing out the J and putting in the W, right? But I'm actually dividing by the time for the cycle. Okay, so we've got a styrofoam cup, 125 grams of water, which they've decided to write in a really complicated way, right? It's at 100 C. It's going to cool to room temperature at 20 C, and we're supposed to figure out what the change in entropy is of the room. Okay, so here's my cup of water. Starts at 100 C, and it's going to go down to 20 C, and in the process, it's going to dump some heat into the room, which is at 20 C. Now, the room's temperature isn't going to be changed very much by dumping a little bit of heat into it, so we can assume that this temperature is constant, and so we can use this formula for the change in entropy. So the change in entropy is going to be the heat that the hot water provides divided by the temperature, of course, in Kelvin. Now, how much heat is the cup going to provide? Well, that's a Q equals MC delta T problem, right? So the energy in the ice, or excuse me, the energy in the water is that famous formula. So we have 0.125 kilograms, the specific heat of water is 4186, and the final temperature is 20, and the initial temperature is 10. So we're, of course, we're 100, I guess I should.
That's 0.125, it looks like a minus sign.
Yeah, it's point. An eighth of a kilogram. Okay. So the heat in the water is negative, right, because it's reduced its energy, but that same magnitude of heat is what was dumped in the it's what was dumped in the room. So I should probably put absolute value signs. One's positive, one's negative, they add up to zero by conservation of energy. So what we've got is 0.125, 4186, and multiply that by 80, and the absolute value of this heat is 4.186 times 10 to the fourth joules, and I want to divide that by 293, and I get 143 joules per Kelvin. So joules per Kelvin are the usual units for entropy. So that's the change in entropy of the room. What's the change in entropy of the water? Remember that the total change in entropy should be positive, right? That's the claim of the second law of thermodynamics. Entropy only increases. So this is how the room's entropy changed. How about the water? Well, it's not something we can do from what's in the book, but I've given you this equation, so let's test it out. So the entropy change of the water is the mass of the water, the specific heat of the water, and then the ratio of the logarithms of the temperatures. So the final temperature is 293, and the initial temperature was 373. So the logarithm of a fraction is going to be negative, so we're going to get a negative change in entropy of it. And what I get is its change in entropy is minus 126 joules per Kelvin. So you can see that the overall change in entropy is positive as required by the second law of thermodynamics. The entropy of the room was increased, the entropy of the water was decreased, but overall the entropy change was positive. For the change in, for the entropy of the water? Because they're totally different, right? So entropy is not the same thing as heat. So different units, different formulas, different quantities.
Wait, you got negative 126 for the, you can't have negative entropy, never mind this.
Yes, I did, negative 126.
I thought you said entropy can't be negative, it can't be below zero.
So what I said is that the entropy change of the entire universe has to be positive, or zero. So this guy went up 143, this guy went down 126, so overall, a positive change in the entropy of the universe.
I didn't get that answer, but I don't know.
Which answer? Okay.
And you said we won't need to know that equation for the test?
Correct. No reason to put that on your cheat sheet.
So could we use the other one?
No, the other one requires the temperature in the denominator to be constant. And here the temperature changed from 100 to 20. So since that formula has a temperature and there isn't a temperature, we can't use it. More questions. What's the change in entropy of 1 kilogram of liquid water as it changes to steam at 100 C? So again, this is a case where we can use that formula because the temperature isn't changing. We've got boiling water at 100 C, we've got steam at 100 C, it's all at 100 C. What we've done is we've added some heat in order to vaporize that water. How much heat did we add? Well, that's the latent heat of vaporization, right? So we go back to this table for water. That's the 3.33 that we were using a lot. That's the amount of energy it takes to melt ice. Here's what we need is the amount of energy it takes to boil water, 2.26 times 10 to the 6th joules per kilogram. So the Q, we got 1 kilogram, so it's 2.26 times 10 to the 6th joules, and we've got 373 for our temperature. So all we need to do is to divide those two to get the entropy change of the boiling water.
Where is that 373? The 273 plus what?
Because it's at 100 C, right? It's boiling. Okay, 2.26 enter exponent 6 and divide that by 373 and I get 606 times 10 to the third joules per Kelvin, the appropriate unit for Okay, so Carnot cycle operates between 100 C and 20 C. How much ice can the engine melt if it is done 5 times 10 to the 4th joules of work? So melting ice, that's the latent heat of fusion. So that's kind of a Q equals MC delta T. So what we need to do is to calculate the heat that we're dumping and then calculate how much mass that's equivalent to. Okay, so we're going to start with the efficiency. So the efficiency is 1 minus the temperature differences. So that's 20 plus 273, which is 293. And 100 is 373. We've calculated that before, but I've forgotten what it is. 293, 373. Is it really that? Well, it's not a number, so I must have lied when I said we calculated it before, because we've never seen that number. 393.
We did the natural log of.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that's what it is in any case. 21%, so not very high efficiency because the temperature difference isn't that much. And we know that this efficiency is the work that was done divided by the heat that we took from the high temperature regime. Well, none of these things are what we want yet, but let's go with it. So we know that the work is 5 times 10 to the 4th joules. So we can calculate the heat that we took from the high temperature regime by taking the work and dividing it by the efficiency. Okay, so 5 enter exponent 4. Okay, so I want to divide that by the 0.21, and what I get is 2.33 times 10 to the 5th joules. So the picture is, here we have this 5 times 10 to the 4th joules. We started with that 233 times 10 to the 5th, so what goes down the pipe is the difference between those, right? So we need to subtract off the 5 times 10 to the 4th joules to figure out how much heat we have to melt the ice. So 5 times 10 to the 4th. So I have 1.83 times 10 to the 5th joules in order to melt ice. So this heat, Q equals the latent heat of vaporization of fusion times mass. And if you've forgotten, the latent heat of fusion of ice is the one that is 33 times 10 to the 5th. So the mass is going to be the heat that we have, 1.83 times 10 to the 5th joules divided by the 3.33 times 10 to the 5th joules per kilogram. That is the latent heat of fusion of the of ice. And what I get is basically half a kilogram. Yeah, so this heat that we dumped, we're going to use to melt ice.
Okay.
And we know that the heat it takes to melt ice is M times the latent heat of fusion.
Okay.
Well, I want to go back, particularly because it's the sort of thing that's going to be on the quiz, to what I would say are more realistic problems. So if you're actually dealing with thermodynamic problems, you don't calculate these entropies by these sorts of formulas. You look them up in books, right? The entropies of these fluids are well tabulated, right? So For this particular table, you can look at the steam tables. This gives you the entropy and the internal energy of water and steam at basically any temperature and pressure you care about. And once you've tabulated these entropies and internal energies, you can use them to calculate accurately heats and works and all sorts of things like that. So for example, if you wanted to calculate how much work the turbine is going to do in going in this adiabatic expansion between 2 and 3, we know that the change in internal energy is equal to the work plus Q. And that's an adiabat, so Q is equal to 0. So the work that's done, we can just calculate as the difference in internal energy, nicely tabulated between those two points. How much heat does it take to boil water at 10 megaparsecs, 10 megapascals, right? So we looked in the book how much heat it took to boil water at atmospheric pressure. How much heat does it take at this really high pressure? So notice that the boiling point is elevated. It's not 100 C, it's 311 C. How could we calculate that? Well, if we look between 1A and 1B, we see that there is a difference in entropy. And we know that the entropy is equal to the heat divided by the temperature. We know what the temperature is. It's a temperature, namely this 311 plus 273. We know what the change in entropy is, so we can calculate the corresponding Q. So realistically, when you have these sort of thermodynamic problems, you're dealing with tabulated entropies and internal energies. You can look them up in your CRC or other sources, steam tables in the case of steam, and we can work out the energetics of this pretty complicated cycle exactly, not using any approximations. Okay, questions? Okay, have a good Thanksgiving.